From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. When's the last time someone swept you off your feet? The last time you felt the rush of romance, that tingling thrill? In this age of hookups, mobile porn, and serial dating, we're taking the temperature of 21st century romance.
I think that online dating has been probably the most important innovation in meeting ever in human history.
Seduction is the way of getting the answer yes. It's a highly sophisticated art, but it's been forgotten.
Sexual desire seems to be the engine for romance. Unless you have powerful sexual attraction, usually the romance doesn't really take wing.
An asexual person is someone who doesn't experience sexual attraction. I can still look at someone and be very attracted to them. It's just not about sexuality.
It's Friday night. You're sitting at home watching television, reading a book. You're single. 20 years ago, you might have headed out to a bar hoping to meet someone new. These days, you don't even have to leave the comfort of your living room to find your next date. Journalist Ann Slater says about 30 million Americans have thrown the fate of their hearts, and not to mention a few other parts, on the mercy of digital matchmakers. He told Steve Paulson what he discovered while working on his new book, Love in the Time of Algorithms.
Dan, you just got married, right?
I did. I got married a week ago Friday down in Las Vegas.
Wow. Congratulations.
Of all places. Thank you very much, sir.
And I have to ask, of course, did you meet your wife on an online dating site?
You know, I did not, but there was a technological component to how we met. When I first asked her out on a date, she said no because she had a boyfriend. And so, you know, a couple of years passed, and I was on Facebook one day, and she popped up in that right-hand column of the people you may know. And so we started to chat, and it turned out that she was single, and so was I. So that's how we reconnected. So it wasn't online dating per se, but I think without Facebook, I would not be married to her right now.
You know, I have to say, this whole world of online dating is pretty foreign to me, and I've been married for nearly 20 years. So
sure.
You'll have to help me out here. There's a fascinating figure that you have in your book. You say that about a fifth of all new relationships begin with people meeting online. What kinds of dating sites are out there?
Oh, there's a dating site for everything now. I think the big ones, the big brand name ones, are the ones that a lot of folks have heard about. These are sites that have communities of millions of people on them. But then once you go beyond that, there are over 1,400 dating sites in the U.S. alone and thousands more abroad that pretty much cater to every interest, hobby, fetish, fringe thing you can possibly imagine. I think that dating sites, after they've been around for a while, they acquire a brand similar to how a bar or some other real-world meeting venue might. So now there is a bar, so to speak, on the web for people who are Star Trek fans. There is even a bar for young men who want to date a grandmother. It is all over the map.
Hmm. I suppose there are some distinct advantages to using these online dating sites. I mean, the obvious one is that you can widen your search. My understanding is that some of the online dating sites make the claim that they are scientific. They have some sort of algorithm that matches up people who are meant to be together or have a good chance of hitting it off. And so this raises the obvious question, is there a science to online dating?
That's probably one of the more interesting questions. There is a vast divide between what psychological science and the academics say is possible and what sites like eHarmony, for instance, what they say is possible. eHarmony will say, we can find you a compatible mate. We can find you someone to marry. The academics say there's no ability to take strangers and say, okay, you and you, you can go off and have a successful 50-year marriage together.
What kinds of data do these sites use? What goes into the algorithms?
Many, many things go into the algorithms. There are some sites that will ask you nothing when you sign up. You know, you need to post a picture and say what your age is and say where you live. But the majority of sites have you input some kind of information. They might ask you 5 questions. They might ask you 500 questions about yourself, about what you're looking for. Other sites will do what is called behavioral matching. So they say, look, people are not very good at assessing themselves. They're not even very good at telling you what they want because they don't know what they want. So we'll be more accurate and we'll be more helpful if we just watch them on our site for a while, see how they behave.
So what would you say online dating sites are best at right now?
I think what online dating sites should aspire to is making a compatible first date. I think that's a fairly amazing improvement over all the rest of dating in, you know, in human history.
Now, there's also new technology, mobile dating. I mean, among gay men, you write, Grindr has been a way for people to know who's available right now and within a certain geographic area. And apparently, this was so popular that during the 2012 Olympics, the server crashed because it was so heavily used. And they've just launched a similar app for straight people.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about this.
Well, I think there's been a lot made of sort of the mobile dating phenomenon because when people think about it, they sort of imagine, hey, I've got 15 minutes to grab some lunch in Midtown. Who's within 400 feet that wants to join me for lunch and or, you know, dessert? I think that that will happen to some extent. There will be this sort of meeting on the fly, especially for younger people.
Now, I would think one of the challenges for people who've done a lot of online dating is that even once they start a new relationship, and let's just say that's what they're interested in, that there would always be this temptation to want something better because there are a lot of fish in the pond.
Well, this is a big theme of the book. One of the things that I attempted to do with the book was to look at what I call the data sphere, the entire world of online dating technology from Facebook to Match.com, et cetera, and to figure out what this means for human relationships. And what I found in my reporting, speaking to both men and women, speaking to both younger people and to older people, was that they found themselves dating a lot more. And I think people who are in happy relationships, I don't think they're going to be hanging out at online dating sites looking for the next best thing. And I think for the ones that tend towards unhappy, the existence of online dating technology will challenge those relationships. And I think for the most part, that may be a good thing.
Dan Slater's book is called Love in the Time of Algorithms. In the uncut version of his conversation with Steve, you can hear more about social media's role in the data sphere. He also told us a fascinating tale about one service that takes single men down to Latin America for a dating holiday. You can find that uncut interview at ttbook.org. There was no online dating for comedian, playwright, and broadcaster Marilyn Pittman. She met her partner the old-fashioned way.
I met my wife many, many years ago. She was in an all-girl rock band, and I was a radio producer in Albuquerque. She was up in Taos. But we weren't friends, and we weren't attracted to each other, and she wasn't even gay. And at the same time, we moved to San Francisco without knowing it, and then we started bumping into each other, but we still weren't friends, and there was still no attraction. So in 97, I'm at the Fillmore to see Patti Smith, the punk rocker. Patti's awesome, but I haven't left the room for so long, and we're all standing up, and it's sweaty, and it's loud, and it's awesome, but I'm tired, and I say, well, I think I'm going to take a breather. So I go, and I sit in the lobby, and all of a sudden, Deb walks by. I just look at her like, it's love at first sight. I can't believe how I feel. Like, hey. And she goes, hey. And I go, hey, can I buy you a beer? And something has changed in me. I was ready to fall in love. I said, let's go out to dinner. We have these like long 5-hour dinners, you know, where we just talk and talk and talk and talk. We have so much in common, whether it's the rock music or the theater we used to do. We have this one conversation about this play that we both did. We recite the lines from the play out loud simultaneously to each other. And I'm wondering, you know, I think this is a date. This feels like a date. This is it, right? This feels like it. I don't really know what it is. And finally, we have a third one of these. And the third one is the one I'm hoping to see if she's feeling what I'm feeling. So we go out, and I drop her off, and we're sitting in my car, and there's that moment of sort of awkward, okay, well, I'll see you again. And I turn to her, and it's a shy moment, and I'm kind of awkward. I don't really quite know what to do. You hope that they want to kiss you. And so I reach to hug her. And as I do this, our heads turn and just our lips lock. And it's this kiss from outer space. It's just like, it's just a hungry animal like this. And it's like that. It's like, oh my God. And a kiss goes on and on and on. And then we separate our bodies and from there, the rest is history. We've been together for almost 15 years.
That's Marilyn Pittman's story of meeting her wife, Deb. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. I don't know whether I believe in love at first sight. Do you? Here's a story from James Bennett about seeing a stranger across a not-so-crowded room. It all begins at the front door of a Canadian disco in the 1970s.
I remember the awning. It was red. The doors, they were scratched. I remember going in. The carpet was old and worn where people had come and gone. It was early in the evening, not too many people there. I looked around, and the first thing I saw was there he was, dancing his little Balinese dance. It was something of a puppet show. He was like he had strings on him, and he was very lyrical and, to me, magical at that moment. And then my next thought was, get the hell out of here. Get out now. We don't want to do this again. So I turned to go, and he came and actually stopped me. When his hand touched me, this little dancer was familiar to me. I could smell him. I could see him. I could understand that this was going to be painful again. He said, "You can't go. You can't go now. We have to do this." So we danced. We danced till midnight, I suppose. But finally, when we were home and talking the night away, one of the things that he told me was that in this lifetime, he was doomed to hurt me because that's what he did. And being young, being 20, you proceed knowing that you can jump off a cliff and live. And so I jumped.
What are you attracted to? What turns you on, do you know? Google might. And so might Ogi Ogus. He is a computational neuroscientist who, with his colleague Sai Gadam, spent years analyzing the erotic habits of web users, all with the aim of reverse engineering human sexual desire. With billions of web searches and millions of websites to study, Ogus had a data set that might have turned Alfred Kinsey green with envy.
This was really the first time scientists could see what people were truly and really interested in. Completely new data, completely new insights. And that's why we found things that were very, very surprising.
So what were some of the surprises?
So different surprises for men and for women, and different kinds of surprises. Some of the surprises for men was the age of women that men were looking for. Now, no surprise, the most common age range that guys are looking for is young women. But what surprised us was the popularity of older women, women in their 40s, women in their 50s, even in their 60s, all have very sizable fan bases among men. Another surprise was body size, body shape, very important for the male sexual brain. Most popular is average body size, but heavy women turn out to be very, very popular. There was three times as many searches for fat girls as there is for skinny girls. Extremely popular, again, in every country that we looked at.
And yet we've always heard that there is kind of this ideal, from a heterosexual male perspective, sort of this ideal female body shape, you know, the large bust, the slender waist, and so on. Are you saying that's not necessarily the case?
The heavy women that do appear in the erotic material, they also have proportions that are similar to sort of the stereotype idea of a woman. It's like a supersized representation of the ideal woman.
Now, the other thing that I found interesting, it's apparently men are really turned on just by visual cues. I mean, it just boom, you know, it just triggers sexual desire, whereas apparently that does not work at all for women.
That's right. So that's a fundamental difference between the male sexual brain and the female sexual brain. Male sexual brain definitely wired to be very aroused by the sight of things. And many, many websites devoted to one specific visual cue. For example, breasts. You know, there's websites where you go and they're pictures, just pictures of breasts and nothing else. There's no women that are looking at page after page of a man's buttocks or a man's chest. There's just doesn't exist. And it turns out gay porn is identical to straight male porn. It's absolutely indistinguishable. The only difference is that it's the man that's the center of attention rather than the woman. So in every country in the world we looked at, straight men search for four body parts. It's breasts, butts, feet, and then the real surprising one is penises. Hmm. Penis is extraordinarily popular.
Really, four straight men?
That's right, yes. Men search for penises pretty much just as often as they search for vaginas in sexual searches. He just wants there to be a large penis in the picture. But these four body parts, chests, buttocks, feet, and penis, same four body parts that gay men search for.
Hmm. So we've been talking about male desire, female desire. Now, one point of clarification, my understanding is your research was mainly just on heterosexual women, right?
That's right. Our research was heavily data-driven, you know, massive data, and also looking at neuroscience, a lot of abstract sort of things. But we always try to anchor it by actually talking to people. And we just had a lot of trouble. I think the reason why is two heterosexual men trying to find out sexual details about lesbian preferences, there was just a wariness about it. As a result, we just didn't get the kind of data that we felt comfortable with.
Well, I want to follow up on what you were saying about what you did find out about straight women.
So the single most popular erotic artifact for women in the world is the romance novel. And just about as many women buy romance novels as men look at online pornography. In the romance novels, there's always a very consistent pattern. There's a dominant, powerful male who have a secret soft side that the heroine, through the course of the story, has to help the man get in touch with.
I saw you give a talk, and you described it as the coconut.
You got to tame the wild coconut. The romance hero is hard and tough on the outside and soft and gooey on the inside. But it's only the heroine can access that soft, gooey interior. That's part of the story. That's part of the romance. It's part of the female archetype of the romance. It's this unique woman. Only she has the power to crack open the man's coconut.
And you said one of the other things that I know you found about women is that one of the things that really turns them on is being desired.
Absolutely. So, you know, women are certainly focused on the man, but they also are highly sensitive to their own feelings, especially how the man's making them feel inside. So very important for a woman to feel she's sexually desirable.
You talk about the sexual desires of heterosexual women as the Miss Marple detective agency. Can you explain what you mean there?
Certainly. So for the male sexual brain, just the sight of one specific thing can be enough to turn a man on. But for the female brain, it requires more information. It causes multiple cues. And the female brain is designed to constantly try to solicit more and more information. What happened in his past, you know, are his social claims, you know, valid? Is he kind or is he pretending to be kind? The female brain has to act like a detective to get answers to these questions before she's willing to have sex with the man.
As I listen to you, I wonder how much of this is biological. Because, you know, you think about the porn industry or the entertainment industry that trades on sexual and romantic fantasies. Is this culturally determined in some way?
So let me talk about that, because that's a very profound question and probably the most important question that we were trying to tackle with this broad body of research. I'd say the answer is mostly biological, but with some qualifications. So for men, it pretty much is biological. The visual things that they're interested in, they're consistent across cultures. And the other thing is that men's sexual interest seem to become fixated sometime in adolescence, and then they don't change for the rest of his life. For a woman, what makes an ideal partner is very context dependent. Women are much more flexible and adaptive in their sexual interests. So women are, in fact, more open to cultural influences in what they find to be sexually arousing.
So what does all this sex research mean for romance, for men and women, straight or not?
Sexual desire seems to be the engine for romance. I mean, what's the biological function of romance? It's to create this irrational basis for a long-term relationship. And I say irrational because you don't think logically anymore. You know, you're designed not to think logically anymore. You think the person's fantastic and perfect and one of a kind, and that you're going to be with them forever and you'll do anything for them. All that's designed to promote long-term bonding with someone and to facilitate sexual production. Certainly, romance is much more than just the sexual attraction, but unless you have powerful sexual attraction, usually the romance doesn't really take wing.
That's Steve Paulson talking with Ogi Ogus. His book is called A Billion Wicked Thoughts. An extended version of his interview is available on our website, ttbook.org. For all its power, sex is not the sole defining feature of romance. In fact, for about 1% of people, sex is not a factor in romantic relationships at all. David Jay is the founder of the Asexual Visibility and Education Network, and Strange Champs asked him what it was like to be an asexual teen in our hypersexual culture.
It was really confusing and really scary. I remember all of my peers all around me and all of my adults all around me expected sexuality to be this thing that I was going to be going through, this thing that was going to be completely reshaping who I was and how I connected with other people and every element of my life.
They expected you to have crushes on girls and stuff like that?
Yeah. Expected me to have crushes on girls, expected me to be really, really nervous about how I was going to, you know, get to explore my sexuality in really early ways. I remember hanging out with my friends and everyone would have conversations about who in our class we thought was cute, what movie stars we thought were cute. And I didn't have a way to answer that question. And I kind of also had this awareness that answering that question, figuring that out was supposed to be a really important part of who I was, how I connected with other people. And that made it scary. That made it really scary.
Were you afraid something was wrong with you?
Yeah. I was really afraid that, I think like a lot of asexual people, that I was broken.
So how did you come across the notion of asexuality as an identity?
I remember being about 13 or 14 and kind of plucked the word asexual out of thin air and started using it to describe myself. And it wasn't until maybe 5-6 years of really struggling with whether that was okay that I came to the realization that it's like a sexual orientation, that it's not a choice, that it's not a problem. It's just a way that I am. When I was 18, I started an organization called the Asexual Visibility and Education Network. And that organization has grown to have about 70,000 members across the globe.
70,000? So obviously this is not that uncommon. What does it mean to you and to others to be asexual?
An asexual person is someone who doesn't experience sexual attraction. So most people feel a desire to make sex a part of how they connect with others. Asexual people don't have that desire. But other than that, we have the same need for connection that everyone else has.
What are some of the common misperceptions?
So they just did a study where they talked about perceptions of asexual people. And the study found that the words associated, wrongly associated with asexuality the most, were inhuman and mechanistic. It's really, really important to understand that that's not true. We have the same desire to connect. We laugh with people just as much. We get hurt just as much. And we have all of the richness and complexity and difficulty of human relationships without this one tiny little activity that many people consider really important, but we don't. I can still look at someone and be very attracted to them. And because I'm attracted to them, I want to get in a conversation with them. I want to spend time with them. And I want to connect with them. And that attraction is so strong that there are people who, in the asexual community, who identify as homoromantic or biromantic or heteroromantic because they're still attracted, romantically attracted to people. It's just not about sexuality.
So this is about decoupling sexual desire from the desire for intimacy or the desire for connection.
Exactly. We've really had this challenge walking around in a sexual world where most people assume that deep intimacy and sexuality go together in some way. And we've had to unvelcro those two concepts. And that's been really hard. We've had to reinvent a lot of the language for how we talk about intimacy. For someone to be single implies that if they're not in a romantic sexual relationship, they don't really have connection in their lives. And for us, every intimate relationship you form counts. If it's romantic, if it's not romantic, if it involves physical touch, if it doesn't involve physical touch, every single person who I connect with is a part of my community and a part of how I have intimacy in my life. And each one of those relationships is worthy of respect.
Would you say your whole life is made up of various forms of friendship, or do you also still have romantic relationships?
So like many asexual people, I have really close friendships and really close romantic relationships. I have a romantic partner who lives in Brooklyn. We met about a year and a half ago. We both felt an energy towards one another that we never felt for anyone before in our lives. She's also asexual. I remember walking away from that experience feeling like there was a new, different, powerful kind of intimacy that I never felt before that I wanted to explore. To me, romance is almost about a spike of adrenaline that I feel at the beginning of a relationship. There's this sense of longing and fear and a desire to just spend lots and lots of time and lots of my emotional energy with one person. And that's different than how I get close with my friends. I get close with my friends because we find ways to be together that are richly, richly empowering, and then we just build on that and build on that and build on that. I think they're kind of different paths to the same feeling of connection.
Can you be asexual and still want physical intimacy? Like with your romantic partner or somebody you fall in love with, do you still want to hug, curl up together?
Oh, yeah. Like most asexual people, I still have a desire for physical touch. And I really, really like it. It's a great way to explore my connection with another person, a great source of intimacy. There's a lot of different places physical touch can go. And part of what's fun for me about being asexual is getting to explore all of that.
So tell me more about your relationship, your romantic relationship with the woman you met through the network. How did you guys meet?
We met because a documentary came out about asexuality. During the reception afterward, we sort of went back and forth and jumped into and out of conversations with one another, and then went on this walk and talked until about 3 a.m. And she lives in Brooklyn and I live in San Francisco. And I spent the entire flight from Brooklyn to San Francisco just writing about this connection with this person and what it meant and how different it was than anything I'd ever felt before. And then we got on a phone call and confessed to one another that we both had really, really strong feelings much, much more quickly than any of us had ever felt before, and decided that we wanted to explore a relationship.
So what, here you are, two people who have fallen in love, from the sound of it, who are in a romantic relationship and who are both defining themselves as asexual. So what issues come up as you structure the relationship?
I think a lot of the discussions that we have about building our relationship are the same ones that you would have in a sexual relationship, but there's some that are different. For example, concepts like monogamy are very complicated to apply, and she and I have decided that we don't want to limit our ability to form close emotional connections with others. Both of us have many deep emotional connections with other people, and we think that helps our relationship rather than hurting it. So we've made a set of commitments to one another.
What kinds of commitments?
Even small things, like we have a commitment to talk to one another once a week. Usually we'll talk for several hours. We message one another in little ways throughout the day. We fly across the country and see one another about once a month. We play a central role in one another's lives as a place to process and reflect and set intentions for where we want our lives to go.
Do you consider yourselves a couple?
Yes. We call one another partners. One of the interesting things about being in an asexual romantic relationship is there's all these scripts for what romantic relationships are supposed to be. We've already kind of taken a really big red marker and crossed out a giant part of that script. We might as well look at the rest of the script, look through it and decide which parts fit with us and which parts don't.
What's in the script?
I think in the script is a certain time when you say that you love another person and a certain meaning that that has. In the script is an expectation about where that relationship will head in the long term and what it will look like for it to head there. And for us, we want to explore a lot of those things on our own terms and don't want to assume that our relationship is going to wind up looking like other romantic relationships.
Yeah, it's really interesting because you seem to have this very unique perspective on the notions we have about romance and sex and intimacy. And the way those, it sounds like what you're saying is our culture has tangled those three things up together. And that tangle has really shaped our social lives.
Exactly. And I think one of the things that I've faced throughout my life, as I've looked at this tangle of intimacy and sexuality and romance, and there have been things in that tangle that I wanted really, really deeply. And there have been things in that tangle that I didn't want. And when I try to tease it out, when I try to take the intimacy that I want and the bits of romance that I want out of that knotted up ball, there's this really, really deep fear that I'm going to lose something really, really important, that I'm going to wind up destroying the very mysterious magic thing that I'm going after. People have come to see sex as a symbol of connection, a symbol of a relationship moving to a newer, deeper level.
We've been talking a lot in the office lately about the nature of romantic love, and maybe there's a kind of quiet revolution sweeping our ideas about relationships. Do you think things are changing?
Yes, I do. When I talk to young people, young asexual people and young sexual people, there's this sense that the labels and the scripts of dating and of romance just aren't as relevant anymore. People are connecting with one another emotionally, not necessarily sexually, more freely than they have in the past. And I think that's a really, really powerful thing. And when I talk to young people, the decision of whether or not to label their relationship as romantic is almost seen as this unnecessarily burdensome sticker sometimes that they put on it. What young people are experiencing is just connection, and it's somewhere between romance and not romance. And once we can describe connection for its own sake, then I think some of the old scripts of romance will fall away. It'll still be a really deep, powerful way that we connect with one another, but it won't be the only way that counts.
That's David Jay, the founder of the Asexual Visibility and Education Network. Like many of the interviews in this show, you can hear an unedited version of Van's conversation with him on our website at ttbook.org. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. When's the last time you met someone who knocked your socks off? Someone whose charm and spirit sparked a deep urge to just be around them? When's the last time you were seduced? Cultural historian Betsy Priolo writes about seductresses and ladies' men. Anne asked her, why seduction?
I've always been fascinated with a seductive power. I grew up in the South in the old days when women didn't have anything else to gain status and achievement. It was only via a man. So as a result, we were raised to seduce. But when I began studying seductresses in literature, I was astounded because the seductresses in literature were really very assertive, different from the training that I had had. Then I began studying seductresses throughout history. I saw that they had been misunderstood. I then turned to men and to see whether the same misunderstanding existed there. I found that they really are not the sexual predators and bad boys of popular lore.
Of course, these days I think seduction feels a bit like a dirty word, kind of implies manipulation.
Yes, that's a complete misunderstanding of the word seduction. Seduction is like charm. It's the way of getting the answer yes. You don't have to play act. You don't have to dissemble in order to attract someone to you. It's a highly sophisticated art. It used to be taught and written about a great deal, starting with antiquity, but it's been forgotten.
So you're not talking about pickup artists, guys who vaunt themselves on their, you know, prowess at getting women to go home to bed with them?
Oh, just the reverse. Seducers love women. They treat them very, very well, and they make them feel wonderful.
When you look through history and began collecting stories about master seducers and seductresses, you know, Cleopatra, Duke Ellington, Casanova, Bill Clinton.
Right.
What did they teach you about what makes for a good seduction?
The first thing you have to have to be a great seducer or a great seductress is that intangible quality, charisma.
Does that mean you have to be beautiful or handsome?
Just the reverse. In fact, as the heroine in Fellini's Juliet of the Spirit says, the powers of seduction are all inside. All of these seducers and seductresses were masters of cerebral charms. Let's take the Russian writer, for example, Ivan Turgenev. Here's a man who enthralled women with his, quote, beautiful faculty of talk. He was tall, stoop-shouldered, and no beauty. Henry James called him an overripe pear. But when he opened his mouth and talked to women, they fell like shot birds.
Wow. Maybe there were men like that around in the past, but do you know any men like that today?
Yes. Actually, one of them I interviewed for my book. That was one of the fun parts about writing.
You telling me you
books.
Traveled around interviewing contemporary seducers?
Well, it didn't, you know, they fell in my lap, to tell you the truth. I didn't plan to do that. I had so many historical examples. And then one night, a priest called me up. I'm not even a Catholic. And this priest called me up and said, I hear you're working on ladies' men, but you must interview this fellow. And sure enough, this man appeared at my door who was, again, not beautiful at all. In fact, he was on the wrong side of 60. And yet he was so charming. He was such an enchanting conversationalist. He loved women so much. You were just drawn into this whirlpool of attraction to him. There are a group of undercover Casanovas who are operating right now underneath the radar, and they have a lot to teach men today.
Okay, so what do they have to teach men?
Well, I think men are at a complete loss right now because they grew up in a hookup culture. They don't know any of the rules, any of the rituals of courtship.
You mean like they don't show up at the door with a dozen red roses and sweep a woman off her feet? But, I mean, most of them would be laughed off the doorstep if they did that.
Yes, if they did it without imagination. But the whole point of this ancient art of love is that whatever you do in courtship has to be creative. It has to be done with swerve and difference and a little bit of drama and surprise. No, you don't want to follow any of those cliched scripts. But I do think that women today are dying for men to resume a passionate approach to woo them.
Sounds like you're saying that seduction and maybe romance are all about paying attention, close, tailored attention, and making the other person feel pursued, desired.
Exactly. Built into the construction of love is idealization of the other. And that's why praise is so important. Everybody wants to be a bigger photoshopped self in love. And that's been embedded in the concept of love since the beginning of time. That's an important courtship tactic for men to resume today. And another one, too, is festivity. In fact, somebody did a study of all of the personals online and in newspapers and found that the number one requirement, which surprised me, was fun.
Looking for a fun time.
Yeah. Well, festivity is an affinity display, and it creates not only a loss of inhibitions, but it draws people together.
And now, what about on the other side? What are men looking for?
Men are fronting right now when they say that they don't want to fall in love. They just want casual partners. They want hookups. What men really want, according to studies, is a grand amour.
Men want the happy ever after, too?
Believe it. They fall in love at first sight much faster than women do. They fare worse after breakups. They are closet romantics.
You know, the truth remains that at least in some parts of the world, gender roles really have changed. Do we now need to figure out a new road to romance, new ways to seduce?
I think so. I think Rimbaud is the one who said it. We need a new myth of love for our age.
Betsy Priolo's latest book is called Swoon. Turns out there are still great seducers out there. Here's a tale from listener Donna McNeil of Portland, Maine.
I have a picture from the day we met. We are walking down a cobblestone street in Montmartre. Olivier is talking, smiling. We are turned toward each other mid-sentence, not looking or really caring where we are headed. An hour earlier, he was a stranger who sat down at my table near Les Cols des Beaux-Arts. He wore a flea market suit coat, trousers ankle short. He talked fast, mixing English and French into a seamless stream, as if his words were trying to keep up with his thoughts. On art, on business, life excited him. He was 20. I was 35. He was Parisian and I a Yankee. "Let me show you Paris," he offered. He guided me through his favorite neighborhoods to the last surviving vineyard in Paris, to the windmill, to the oldest bar, by the strip joints and music stores. We drank in the perfectly preserved 50s Café Les Deux Moulins. We watched women dropping duvets from windows to air. We greeted the ladies of the evening. He took me home, fed me grilled rabbit, took me to bed. In those days, you could fly round trip Boston to Paris for $300. I must have flown at least 30 times to meet a man who pulled me into doorways for pillowed kisses, who pressed me to him through the metro turnstiles and found his way up my skirt on a train ride. When we were apart, he sent me letters he'd written, cut and woven, a love letter, a puzzle, a game. Even now, sometimes, when I wake up at dawn, I remember the early morning phone calls, his lunch break, his playful voice sweetening my sleepy warmth, the sound of France. On one trip, Olivia gave me a little pin that was his grandfather's. It's in the shape of a bow, half American flag, half French. You see, we were allies. 2 years later, I decided to move to Paris, although not for him. Our impossible long-distance romance had quieted. One winter night, we found ourselves at a party together. We danced. I loved dancing with him. Later, outside, at the foot of Sacré-Cœur, he hailed me a cab. It was snowing, big, slow flakes, magical in the light of the cathedral. Time changed. Everything was perfectly, quietly beautiful. Olivier turned to face me, offering a clear-eyed promise. "I will always be your friend," he said. And now, 30 years, many loves, I know he meant it.
So romance is about encounters, about desire, about seduction, and sometimes about sex. Romance is also about love. Oh, we love romantic love. But do we know what it is? Psychologist Barbara Fredrickson says it's time to redefine that funny little thing called love.
Love is that moment of connection that you feel when you look into someone's eyes, or you're feeling the same way, and you momentarily have a sense of mutual concern for one another. Now, that kind of a moment can happen between you and your soulmate or you and a complete stranger. They're good for the body and they're good for our relationships. They're sort of the building blocks of many other things.
How do I know when one of these moments is happening?
When you get the sense that you and another person are on the same page or on the same wavelength or really connecting, all emotions, by definition, are potent mind and body events, changing your biochemistry, changing your gestures, changing your neural firings. And when two people are experiencing this micro moment of connection, then there's something very interesting unfolding across two brains and bodies at once. People's neural firings become synchronized, their gestures become synchronized, their biochemical reactions become synchronized, to the point where it becomes a real open question. Is this love happening for just one person, or is it something that's happening across two brains and bodies at once?
I mean, I've had experiences like this. I have images in my mind of my grandson arriving at the house and throwing his arms wide, and I can feel the whole world start to open up.
Exactly.
Is it also that same thing that's happening if I smile at a stranger on the street and they smile back?
That's a milder version, I would say, yeah, because a smile comes with a certain brain activation behind it. And when you catch somebody else's smile, you're mirroring not just what muscle movements are showing up on your face. There's a deeper mirroring going on where your brain activation is more similar to each other than it was a moment before that smile occurred. So that smile on the street is a smaller, milder version of the connection you feel with your grandson when he runs towards you with a hug.
Does it bother you at all to use the word love to cover all of these things?
You know, it is difficult to take on a word like love because people have so many strong pre-existing views of it, hard-won views, you know, that come from personal experience and just absorbing our cultural messages as well. And so I see these micro moments of connection as being the real heart of a broader love system. And they're the actionable pieces. You can actually decide, I want to feel more connected with people today and make a change in how you interact with people and achieve that. Whereas if you say, well, I want more love relationships today, that's going to be tougher to act on.
What you're talking about is an improved sense of positive relationships with people. It's both bigger and smaller.
Right, I agree. It's bigger in terms of our potential to have some control about whether and when we feel these states. And it's smaller because it takes love off that pedestal of being high romance or only reserved for our loved ones. And it says, no, actually, love is something about how we connect with people, everybody. But I don't think it's important that people use the L word. What I think is important is that we see these micro moments of positive connection as nourishment, you know, a way to connect and a way to be giving and a way to make ourselves and others healthier.
I want to talk about those physical responses to love because it sounds as though you're saying we will be healthier with greater moments of happiness, of positive
connection. Positive connection with others. We've known for decades that people who have experiences of more positive emotions and more social connections are healthier and live longer. But one of the great mysteries has been, how is it that those feelings get under the skin and literally make us healthier? Vagal tone is something that we've done quite a bit of research with, and that is the 10th cranial nerve that connects your brain to your heart and other internal organs. It's good for you to have high vagal tone, and it signals flexibility and adaptability in how our body regulates internal biological systems and how our minds regulate attention and emotion. It's really a good predictor of both psychological and physical health. improvements in vagal tone offers one window into understanding that mystery, into seeing, oh, this is how those feelings affect health over the long term. And now my research team is actually looking at changes in gene expression in the immune system, seeing how your white blood cells change in step with experiencing greater frequency of micromoments of positive connection.
The redefinition of love you've presented in some ways bursts the popular myths about love, that it is only between two people or that it's a lasting state.
Right, right. And so we can see the importance in our cherished relationships of making sure we keep the gateways open to experiencing continued positive shared moments rather than just resting on our laurels and thinking, you know, yeah, he told me he loved me 20 years ago. It still stands. We need to rekindle these moments as often as we can to make our relationship stronger.
You've done all of this research now. Why is it, do you think, that we are so obsessed with the idea of love?
You know, it's one of these really powerful psychological states that seems mysterious. It feels like a lightning bolt coming down from the sky when you love at first sight. Or these really intense moments of love are certainly the most memorable, but it could be that they're not the most consequential in terms of our longevity and our health. The research has shown in the past that mild, low-intensity, but frequent positive experiences are the ones that may be nourishing us the most on a day-to-day basis.
That's psychologist Barbara Fredrickson. Her new book is called Love 2.0. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can hear extended versions of almost all of our interviews from this hour on our website, ttbook.org. If you want to share a tale of seduction, romance, or just plain animal desire, you can also find us on Facebook. And stay tuned. A couple of weeks from now, we'll bring you an hour on what happens after the romance. You can buy a copy of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Love, Lust, Longing. Special thanks to Jen Paulson and Jason Huggins for giving our theme tune a romantic remix this hour. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Sarah Nix, with the help of Anne Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, Doug Gordon, and Veronica Rickert. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.